Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we all have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the Book of Judges with Tola and Jair. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. In the book of Judges, we've been studying this brief record of the early history of the nation of Israel under these rulers who ruled under Jehovah called the Judges. And we saw that after the death of Gideon, the fifth judge, Abimelech, his son through a slave woman, rose up, inspired to kill all his brothers or his half-brothers, and pronounce himself king in defiance of Jehovah, the true king. Of all his brothers, only Jotham, the youngest, escaped and cursed Abimelech and his hometown of Shechem that supported him, that they would destroy each other. Last time we saw how Abimelech and his home city turned against each other, and how he ended up slaughtering the people of the city of Shechem. And he not only pulled it to the ground, but he also sowed its farming fields with salt, making it just about impossible to live there, of course, until the salt washed away and you could plant again. Verse 46, "Now when all the men of the Tower of Shechem had heard that, they entered the stronghold of the temple of the god Beeroth." Now, the men of the Tower of Shechem hear this. Now, their towns back then were built in kind of a two-ring pattern, or there would be an outer city, and then often there would be an inner fortress. They both have fortifications. They both have protection. But it was made so that if an enemy got into the outer fortress, the people of the city could flee into the inner fortress. If any of you have watched The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, you would see an example of that in that movie. A city that's built, of course, that's a fantasy city, but that's how cities were really built back then. When the outer fortress is taken, they run to the inner fortress, which is, again, heavily fortified. So the men of this Tower of Shechem hear about the slaughter of the rest of the people, and they run into this fortified place, which is in the temple of their god, Baal-Berith. We talked about before, meaning the Lord of the Covenant, but this false god that they were worshiping instead of the true God. Verse 47, "And it was told Abimelech that all the men of the Tower of Shechem were gathered together." So Abimelech hears about this, that the men of this tower have gathered together and are holding up in this fortified place in this temple, and they're trying to hold out against him. Now he has wiped the rest of the people of Shechem out, but he's not willing to let these go, it seems. So verse 48, "Then Abimelech went up to Mount Salmon, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bough from the trees, and took it and laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people who were with him, 'What you have seen me do, make haste and do as I have done.'" So he goes to nearby Mount Salmon, which basically means the shady mountain, must be a forested mountain, with his men. And he uses an axe there to cut down a bough from the trees, or we might call this brushwood, and he puts this on his shoulder. And then he told his people to hurry and do the same thing they had just seen him do, and all copy him. Verse 49, "So each of the people likewise cut down his own bough and followed Abimelech, and put them against the stronghold, and set the stronghold on fire above them, so that all the people of the Tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women." So all Abimelech's followers did this same thing, cutting down boughs, brushwood, and putting it on their shoulders. So the question arises, why did they do this? Was it for camouflage? If this tower was surrounded by forest, maybe they'd be hard to see approaching it under this brushwood. But whether or not he had that in mind, certainly he had in mind that they used this wood to pile against the base of the tower and start the tower on fire. So they pile up this pile of brushwood around the base of the tower and they set it afire. And so this fortified tower catches on fire, and so that all these mortal men of the tower died along with the rest of the people of Shechem. And we read that the people who were in this tower were about 1,000 men and women, the rest the only remaining inhabitants of Shechem. So Shechem, Abimelech's home city, and the ones who supported him becoming quote-unquote king, they are paid back for their wickedness. And this fulfills, in fact, quite literally, what Jotham, Abimelech's youngest brother, had said in his curse back in Judges chapter 9 and verse 20. He says, but if not, in other words, if you haven't done right by your family, wiping out all your 70 half-brothers, he says, if not, let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Millo. And let fire come from the men of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech. Well, here quite literally, we see that fire has come from Abimelech and devoured the men of Shechem and Beth Millo. So just like Jotham said, the Lord brought it to pass. The men of Shechem were destroyed. But Abimelech still is not destroyed, and he was just as guilty, just as culpable in the slaughter, the assassination of his 70 brothers, and his proud usurpation over Israel as the men of Shechem were. And yet we see he too was destroyed, starting in verse 50. Then Abimelech went to Thebes, and he encamped against Thebes and took it. So he attacks another city, Thebes, which means brightness. So it seems that the discontent with his rule spreads beyond Shechem. And remember, Abimelech, at best, I've said that he was kind of a robber baron, a robber king, more than he maybe was a national king. I believe that Tola, the next judge, was over Israel at the same time, and he was just kind of a rival trying to establish a court. And how many people in Israel really followed him, I don't know. But it seems that Thebes is just as unhappy with his rule, or he's just as unhappy with Thebes anyway, as he was with Shechem, so he goes and attacks them. And he camps around it, and he captures it as well. Verse 51. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women, all the people of the city, fled there and shut themselves in. Then they went up to the top of the tower. So this city too has a strong tower, an inner stronghold. And it seems that Abimelech doesn't succeed at slaughtering these people, because they all run to the tower, not just some of them. All the men and women run there and flee there. And they shut up the tower, and they all go up to the top of this tower as Abimelech comes to attack it. Verse 50. So Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it, and he drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. So Abimelech, it seems, tries the same plan that had worked with Shechem, and that is that he plans to set this tower on fire as well in order to kill those in it. Well, he's getting near to the door. He probably has some brushwood again with his men. He's going to try to set this tower on fire too. Verse 53. But a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. So when Abimelech gets close to this tower, he wants to be close in to set it on fire, a woman sees how close it is and she gets an idea. She takes a millstone. Now understand, millwork back then was women's work. They would take the grain after it had been harvested and brought in from the field, and they'd put it down on a stone slab, and they'd take another stone, which was called the upper millstone, and the stone slab was the lower millstone. They'd take another smaller stone that they'd use, and they'd grind the grain under this upper stone against the lower stone, kind of like a mortar and pestle. Except, of course, mortar is a curved bowl, and this was just two stones. And that would grind the grain, it would break off the hard outer shell and allow the soft grain, the good part that you wanted, to come out. Well, she takes this upper millstone, probably, and well, the upper millstone, of course, wouldn't be too huge. You want it big enough to crush the grain, but small enough that the woman could handle it and move it around easily enough. And yet, dropped from the top of the tower, it was quite a missile by the time it reached the bottom. And so she drops, with great accuracy, she drops this millstone right on Abimelech's head. And it crushes his skull when it hits him. Verse 54. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor-bearer, and said to him, draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, a woman killed him. So his young man thrust him through, and he died. So Abimelech realizes that he's mortally wounded. He's going to die from his crushed skull. So he calls to the young man who bears his armor. his right-hand man, we might say, and tells him to come to him quickly and draw his sword and finish him off, because he doesn't want the shame of having people say that a woman killed him. And so we see right to his death, Abimelech is a man of ambition. He wants to be king, usurp Jehovah's place over the land, and then when it seems he's going to die, well, he doesn't want to be shamed in his death. People say a woman killed him, so he says, "You kill me, armor bearer, so no one can say a woman killed me." So the young man does as he asked, but notice it didn't really work. The Lord records in the Bible what really happened. We know that what really killed him was this woman dropping the millstone on his head. And he just had the armor bearer finish the job or cause it to happen more quickly. But thus, shamefully ends this ambitious usurper. Verse 53, "And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed, every man to his place." Well, remember, Abimelech was trying to establish a court, a central government for Israel with himself as the head. And like I say, how much of Israel took him seriously, I don't know. Some did, it seems. And yet when he dies, his court, such as it was, broke up. His attempt to form a centralized government with a king, contrary to the Lord, failed, because everybody who had gathered to him just went back to their own homes. So that was the end of Abimelech's attempt at setting up a royal court in Israel. Verse 56, "Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers." So God now sums up what we've just read in this chapter. And he shows us that what happened here to Abimelech, though it seems to just be natural circumstances, was really God moving behind the scenes to return on Abimelech's head his wickedness, which he did to his own father when he killed all his 70 brothers, or his half-brothers, in order to eliminate any threat from them and to take the throne. Verse 57, "And all the evil of the men of Shechem God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal." So the calamity caused by the men of Shechem in helping Abimelech wipe out his half-brothers and take this throne, well, that also falls on their heads and they're destroyed. And thus Jotham's curse comes on them. Again, the fire coming out of Abimelech and destroying them, proving that his words were prophetic indeed of what God would really do. So this was Abimelech's fall, and this was the end of this usurper king in the book of Judges. But now we come to chapter 10, and we go right back to God's judges. And first we have the sixth judge, Tola, starting in Judges 10 and verse 1. It says, "After Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, and he dwelt in Shamir in the mountains of Ephraim." So the next judge, the sixth one, is Tola, which means worm. Not a very likely name. But he is the son of Puah, which means either splendid or mouth. Again, some of these names difficult of derivation. And Puah was the son of a man named Dodo. Now we think of the dodo bird as being a silly bird, and someone who's a dodo is silly. But in Hebrew, it means belonging to love, or beloved one. Now this Tola is a man of Issachar. Issachar, meaning recompense, was of course one of the tribes of Israel, and not one of the greatest tribes, not one we typically attach with government. And Tola was the only judge from this tribe of Issachar. The only other ruler from Issachar was the wicked Baasha of Issachar, who took the throne in the northern kingdom after the land of Israel was divided. It seems that though Tola is from Issachar, however, he doesn't hold his judge's court in Issachar, but he moves instead to Shamir, meaning sharp point or thorn. And Shamir is in the large and more governmental tribe of Ephraim. So he goes to Shamir to hold court rather than in Issachar, which farther north, more on the borders of Israel, would be a less centralized place from which to govern as judge. Verse 2. He judged Israel 23 years, and he died and was buried in Shamir. So his judgeship lasts for 23 years. And again, as we discussed regarding Abimelech, the first 3 years of his 23 seems to overlap with Abimelech's 3 years. So the Lord more or less ignores Abimelech and raises up his own judge. And when Abimelech meets his rightful end, the way is made clear for Tola to be the true judge over the land. Now after 23 years of his judgeship, he dies, and he is buried in Shamir, in the place that he chose to be his capital, or his seat of judgeship, rather than being buried back in Issachar, his home tribe. So that is the end, and the short career of Tola, the sixth judge. Probably important if you're living in the land at the time, but not a lot of important events happen in his judgeship for us to review. So that brings us to the seventh judge, Jair. Verse 3. After him arose Jair, a Gileadite, and he judged Israel 22 years. Now Jair means he enlightens. Good name. And we read that he was actually a Gileadite, which means that he dwelt east of the Jordan. And he becomes the seventh judge. Now, Gilead is land, like I said, east of Jordan. Most of Israel, the main part of Israel that the Lord meant to give to Israel, was a land west of the Jordan and east of the Mediterranean Sea. But remember, 2.5 tribes after Moses conquered the land east of the Jordan, 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, asked to have their lands on the eastern side of the Jordan. Now, part of that was the land of Gilead, which technically belonged to the half-tribe of Manasseh. But sometimes Gilead seems to be used just as a generic name for all the land east of the Jordan. So Jair could have been from Manasseh, most likely was from Manasseh. But the point is that he was from east of Jordan. Now he judged over Israel again for 22 years. One less year than Tola, but pretty close to the same amount. So between the two of them, 22 plus 23, we get 45 years between these two judges. And they seem to have more or less judged in peace, other than the internal turmoil with Abimelech at the beginning of Tola. Verse 4. Now he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys. They also had 30 towns, which are called Havoth-Jair to this day, which are in the land of Gilead. So what was significant about this judge? Well, he has at least a little more to say about him than about Tola. This judge is famous for having 30 sons. Well, it's just counting the sons, but assuming 30 sons, he probably also has close to that number, maybe 30 daughters. Well, that's, of course, I think we can pretty safely say that's more than is likely or probably even possible from one wife. So it's pretty safe to say that this man was a polygamist, had more than one wife. Now these 30 sons, we read, rode on 30 donkeys. So it seems that Jair obeyed the law about horses. We find in Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verses 15 through 17, where the Lord says regarding kings over Israel, not necessarily judges, he says, "You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, for the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again." And so that was important. The Lord didn't want the rulers of Israel to multiply horses. It seems that Jair doesn't do that. He has donkeys for his kids, not horses. But notice what the next verse of Deuteronomy 17 says. "Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself." So Jair follows, it seems, the thing about horses, but not the thing about wives. Otherwise, he couldn't have had 30 sons if he hadn't multiplied wives. Now, we also read that he takes these sons and he makes them rulers over 30 cities. Well, that makes sense, I suppose. We talk about nepotism, but really it makes sense if you're a ruler. Who can you trust more than your own children? You figure. Plus, if you give them authority, they're going to be less likely to be ambitious and want to take over your position. So he makes them all, we would say mayors, but rulers over 30 cities. And so these cities we read were called Havoth-Jair, which basically means the villages of Jair. And the author tells us they're still called Havoth-Jair to this day. Well, of course, that doesn't mean right now. They certainly aren't still called Havoth-Jair. Most of them probably don't exist anymore. But this means the author's days. If we go back to my speculation, I think the author of Judges, we don't know. Maybe we could guess Samuel. He'd be a pretty good guess. That he not only started the book of Samuel, he dies in it, so he obviously didn't finish the book of Samuel. But he not only started the book of Samuel, but he probably finished the book of Judges. Although Judges, being written, I call it chronicle style, taking in hundreds of years of history, could have been passed from one prophet to the next until finally one prophet finished it. If so, Samuel probably finished it. Who started it, we don't know. But if Samuel finished it, this would mean all the way to Samuel's days, it was still called the villages of Jair. Verse 5, and Jair died and was buried in Kamon. So Jair died. And he is buried in Kamon, which means either raised or abounding in stalks. And don't know exactly where that is, but no doubt it was in Gilead, where he had lived and where his judgeship had taken place. But now, after a relative time of peace, the old cycle of judges starts again with further apostasy. Verse 6, then the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtoreths, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. And they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. So the cycle starts again. The people of Israel, after Jair's death, forget the Lord. And they do the evil again in turning to other gods and serving idols. Now this time they serve many other gods. I mean, they are very prolific in which gods they take in. They take in the Baalim, the Baals, and the Ashtoreths, or the Asheropoles. And these were from the Canaanites, who had actually lived in their land, and they failed to wipe them out. Some of them lived south of their land. Then they take in the gods of Syria. That's, the Bible calls it Aram. We call it Syria today. That was north of Israel. They worship the gods of Sidon. Sidon was northwest of Israel. They worship the gods of Moab. Moab was southeast of Israel. They worship the gods of Ammon. Ammon was northeast of Israel. And they worship the gods of the Philistines. The Philistines were southwest of Israel. So pretty much every single nation around them, you go all the way around in a circle around the land, except maybe south, which was mostly wilderness. And they worship the gods of all of them. And on top of this, they didn't just add worshiping them to serving the Lord. They forsook the Lord altogether. They didn't serve him. They just served all these other gods instead. Well, how sad. But how typical. Israel does this over and over again. And this is what the Lord warned them would happen if they didn't wipe out the Canaanites from their land, if they allowed these idolaters to remain and influence them. And they did influence them, as we see here. So we see in this portion the well-deserved end of Abimelech. After he destroyed Shechem, his co-conspirators, Jehovah took care of him, and he was killed while attacking another city, Thebes. His usurpation was followed, in fact even paralleled, with Tola, the sixth judge, and then Jair, the seventh judge, who judged Israel in relative peace. But then Israel again forsook the true God to serve the gods of the nations around them. Well, how sad that Israel wasn't more faithful, but look at us. Are we any more faithful to the true God? Well, I pray that we at least individually will be.
Once Abimelech is off the scene, Israel enjoys around 45 years of relative peace under the judgeship of Tola and then Jair. After Jair dies, The cycle of Israel's ups and downs continues as they forsake their God by once again falling into the practice of idolatry. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on Tola and Jair. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Judges with Jephthah, the prostitute's son. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that as you listen to this program, you are becoming more and more motivated to study God's Word. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. We also offer a weekly email newsletter in which Nathan does the same thing he does on this radio program, going verse by verse through the Bible and then discussing what it means. Email Nathan at nathan@knowinggodintheword.org and ask to be placed on his mailing list. You can also write to us with Bible questions or comments. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible Studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org or write to the Word of Truth Ministry at P.O. Box 1609, Canyon Country, California, 91386. Although your donations are always appreciated, you will not be solicited for funds in any way when you write, so feel free to contact us. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.